Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, I am joined by Dr. R.V. Paul Chan from the Illinois Eye and Ear Infirmary. We discuss retinopathy of prematurity topics, including a review of basic terminology, advances in medical treatment, and the role telemedicine will play in the future.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. R.V. Paul Chan. Dr. Chan is professor of ophthalmology at Illinois Eye and Ear Infirmary at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. He's also the director of the Pediatric Retina and Retinopathy of Prematurity Service there and serves as the co-director of the Vitreoretinal Fellowship. And finally, he's vice chair of global ophthalmology. Dr. Chan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Jay. Thanks for having me.
So we have lots of trainees who listen in who like to hear how people who are prominent in the field got where they are today. So let's start by just talking about how did you decide to become an ophthalmologist? And was it something that you knew going to medical school, or was it something that you came across in your studies?
Yeah, so I mean, that's always a great question. And first off, I'll sort of say that I don't necessarily think that I'm prominent in the field. I just sort of do my job. I think that in large part, a lot of things just kind of happen, sort of by chance. But also, full disclosure, both my parents were ophthalmologists, right? So my father, who's Guy Chan, who actually was the person who made that wrist rest that we all use, was an ophthalmologist, and also, he was chair at Temple for many years, and also was, I think he was director of medical education at Wills, many years ago, I think in the late 60s. And my mom was an ocular pathologist, having trained with Dick Green down at Hopkins. But so, it was kind of hard for me to not be an ophthalmologist, although admittedly I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, going into med school. And then it just switched basically because I liked it. And fortunate enough to really just get into ophthalmology, and find my way, through the field.
And then you go into ophthalmology. Retina was something that was high on your priority list going in, or did you kind of look at all the fields and then make a decision?
Yeah, retina, it's interesting you ask that. I think that, again, all sort of, I use my parents as a role model, but, my father always used to tell me that, he could do a lot of things as, a general trained ophthalmologist, but, one thing that he couldn't do was retina. And, I think, for the most part, for me, retina was something that I was interested from the very beginning, just because of the mentors that I had. One in med school, I did some work with Bill Benson, at Wills, and he had a huge influence in my life in terms of just giving me good advice, and supporting me and believing in me. And then a guy named Steve Wong at Temple, so all these people in retina sort of pushed me along the way. And then, as a resident at Cornell, Tom Lee and Jack Coleman, tremendous impact in my life. And then, so it's all these mentors along the way who sort of influence you, and help guide you along the way. And then, fellowship, obviously, at Mass Eye and Ear with all the folks there, with Don and Dr. Gudis and Joan Miller and all these people that, really supported me. She has Mu Kai with C. Young, Ivana Kim, who's probably one of my best friends. So I think that, yes, you sort of go into this world of ophthalmology with some preconceived notion of what you're going to end up doing. But then I think what pushes you along the way is really the people who support you, believe in you, give you opportunities, and that you really connect with, right? And I've been very fortunate in that respect.
Before we move on, just because we both know Bill Benson well, do you have a favorite Bill Benson?
Oh, yeah.
A favorite quote? Because he's a very quotable guy.
I was never his trainee, right? So I was the medical student, and I remember, the first time I connected with him, actually Bill Tasman said, I have, one of my guys has, can help you out, Paul, and, has some projects for you. And I remember talking to him on a cell phone, he's on his driving home to the suburbs of Philadelphia, and he talked to me about his projects. But, I don't necessarily know if I have a Bill Bensonism, but, you know, I always remember him in terms of just the advice he gave me when I finally matched into residency. And he said, you know, Paul, do something that nobody else wants to do and get really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that people tell you all the time, but, you know, he's probably the first person that really told me that from a career perspective, you know, sitting in his office. And, you know, 2020 hindsight, you know, I look at my life now, you know, I ended up doing pediatric retina and ROP care.
Right, right.
And, you know, as we all know, this isn't necessarily something that people want to do, and a lot of people don't do it. And, you know, again, you know, feel very lucky that I fell into it, liked it, and you know, hopefully I'm pretty good at it.
So, how did you end up in pediatrics? That was my next question, is how do you go from,
yeah,
I'm going to do retina to I'm going to be a pediatric, do a lot of pediatric retina or focus on retinopathy of prematurity?
Yeah, and I think that again, it's like serendipity. You know, when I started my first job, you know, you reach these forks in the road after your training, and you sort of have this, you know, these decisions to make about where you want to go. And at the time, you know, when I finished my residency, I was actually promised a job, or given a job, offered a job, by Jack Coleman, and you know, to come back after fellowship. And it was an interesting transition because at the time, Don D'Amico, you know, who I was training with, was then going to be chair at Cornell, and, you know, at the same time was offered a position at Mass Eye Nursing on in their K-12 program. You know, so I was trying to figure that out, right? I was trying to say, okay, well, should I go back to Cornell? I kind of already committed to doing that, or stay at Mass Eye here with my mentors there. And that was a tough decision. And, you know, ultimately, after long conversations with all of them, all of my mentors, I ended up going back to New York. And it wasn't really my intention to do peds. You know, it wasn't my intention to do ROP care because Tom Lee was still there. And ultimately what happened is he left. You know, and Tom left about a month and a half after I started to go to Los Angeles. It's, as we all know, you know, it's one of those things where, you have to be there all the time. And, it's something that I really just dove into. So it was partially by chance. Obviously, I made it a choice down the line to commit to it. And it's really been one of the best things I've ever done.
So let's talk about ROP, and just not to be too basic, this is going to be, but just for, you know, for retina specialists who are maybe not seeing ROP all the time, or fellows or residents, just talk about quickly about some definitions, right? So when you see a kid or a baby with ROP, let's just quickly review staging, zone, plus, and how those factor into your treatment decision.
Right. So, you know, good questions to sort of drill down to basics. You know, in terms of just the exam itself, I mean, obviously we have set criteria, and, you know, we have protocols, you know, that we follow of, you know, when to examine a child and how often to follow them and so forth based on what we see. You know, at least in the U.S., we have these very strict guidelines that we go by, right? And we work closely with neonatology. Basically, if I'm asked to go see a child and say I'm doing an indirect exam versus necessarily, you know, we can sort of talk about the whole image-based diagnosis piece.
Right.
But going into the NICU, you know, the first thing I look at is dilation and making sure that they're well dilated. You know, obviously you want to look for neovascularization of the iris to see if there's any issues there. And, you know, the one thing we look for initially is the presence or absence of plusses, you know, which is, you know, arterial tortuosity and venous dilation of two quadrants or more in the posterior, in that posterior area. And obviously that whole definition also, you know, is it's evolving, I think, to a certain extent, you know, because we're learning new things about plusses, and we can talk about that if we have time. But plusses is a very important factor that we look at. And then in terms of zone and stage, obviously, you know, if you want me to, do you want to go to basics, or do you want me to just sort of,
yeah, let's
think about. Okay, so Jay, so when we think about ROP and the exam itself, you know, we're looking at zone, stage, the presence or absence of plusses. And I think plusses is a very important consideration, you know, because that's really when we need to treat, you know, either with laser or, you know, in some cases, you know, anti-VEGF treatment. So zones, you know, I think about it in terms of the geography, right? So how far is the vasculature developed? So we have zone 1, zone 2, zone 3. The way I describe it to families is, zone two is sort of an intermediate area. Zone three, we're sort of almost home. Zone one is very immature. And then we have stages, right? So we have stage one, two, three, four, which is divided into 4A and 4B, and stage five, which is total retinal detachment. Stage one really is early, ROP, just demarcation line. Stage, there's some elevation, and a ridge. And stage three is actually when we, can see neovascularization. 4A and 4B is when there is a retinal attachment. 4A, is not fovea involving. 4B is when the macula is involved. And as I mentioned before, stage five is when there's a total RD. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we have in mind too is that, a lot of people who do ROP, they will say that stage three in zone one, may look a little bit different or may look differently than, stage three in zone two. So we have to keep that in mind, because when you have, at least by definition, zone one with stage three, without plus disease, that's indication for treatment, right? So let's then go into when we treat, and we split these into categories like type two pre-threshold and type one ROP, mm-hmm. and we treat when there's type one. And I think the easiest way to think about it, to sort of keep it in your, in your mind is, if you have plus disease, you treat, and that's type one. And if you're in zone one with stage three, with or without plus, you treat. And that is based on really the ETROP study.
Great. And then let's talk about treatment. You said there's protocols for treatment, but now we have a different option. We have anti-VEGF. There's a lot of debate, I know, in the community about the role of anti-VEGF versus laser. How do you incorporate anti-VEGF in your practice, and how do you see this evolving as we go forward?
Yeah, and I think, again, it's evolving, right? And I think that, historically speaking, laser has been great, right? It's been a great option. If you know how to do laser well, it works, even for zone one. Although, we have to keep in mind that when you look at the studies, laser didn't work for everybody, right? And I think that for cases where there's aggressive disease and so forth, we're looking for other options for when laser may not work as well, right? So it's interesting because now we have anti-VEGF treatment. People are using ranibizumab, people are using bevacizumab. I think some people have advocated for even using aflibercept, right? So there's all sorts of different drugs out there to potentially use in ROP. I think the one drug that people have most experience with is bevacizumab, obviously, and now there are studies looking at ranibizumab with the Rainbow trial. And also dosing is an issue, right? We don't know what the correct or appropriate dose is, right? And you can have a very small dose that may work. And I think the PEDIC study started to show that even very small dosages of bevacizumab work, right, or promote regression of disease. So, the bottom line is, we know that anti-VEGF promotes regression of disease, but there are all these other things that we're not, fully clear about, right? So dosing of the drug, what are the long-term effects? Are there any potential neurological issues? We kind of assume these things might happen, but we don't have the definitive evidence that, what are the long-term adverse events, right? But we're learning more, right? So over the past, I think, 10 years or so, we've learned a lot regarding, yes, we can see recurrence, so we have to follow these kids pretty closely, until they fully develop. We are seeing cases where there's persistent avascular retina, what do we do? So the one thing about anti-VEGF treatment that's tricky is that, we have this very good treatment in laser, where we have clear definitions of when to treat, but then you have this anti-VEGF therapy where I don't think there's really a consensus agreement on when do we treat, right? We can go back to the BEAT-ROP and follow those, that study's protocol and, treating with zone one, stage three plus. But there are certain, we have to use clinical judgment as well. Right. If you have APROP, are you better off using anti-VEGF treatment or not? And I think these are all things that we have to consider. So it's very exciting that we have other options. And I think that in terms of the big picture, when we treat ROP, these are the things we have to have very clear discussions with the family about in terms of what our treatment options are, laser versus anti-VEGF treatment, why one might be better than the other, and what we know and don't know, right? So it's all about an informed consent, and also just balance, right? So I think that we have to, you know, present that to families and explain all these treatment options to them so that, you know, they're educated and understand also the long-term follow-up issues.
Dr. Chan, we've talked a lot about medical issues. From a surgical perspective, what advice would you have for newly graduated retina fellows who are going out to practice, who are encountering pediatric cases that may require surgery?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that for many of us who, you know, started out, you know, we all remember, you know, what that was like in terms of, you know, dealing with surgery. I think, you know, the best advice I can probably give people is just know your limitations, right? So I think that we all come out very well trained as adult vitreoretinal surgeons. I think that there's definitely a steep learning curve for pediatric retina, even if we do go to one of the fellowships, you know, that focus on that. But I think know your limitations, ask for advice. Very importantly, you know, it's interesting because I think that if you always keep in mind that it's all about the patient, all about the child, all about the family, you know, that sort of helps you in terms of guiding your management. You know, also very importantly, you know when not to operate, right? So know when, potentially you're dealing with a situation where it's best not to operate. Because, you know, one thing that I think for many of us who manage these children, we say time and time again, you know, a pediatric eye and a child's eye, it's not just, like dealing with, you know, a small eye or a small adult eye. You know, these are very different anatomical considerations, you know, so we have to be very aware of that. Also, you know, I think very importantly, you have to work closely or have a very good relationship with a pediatric ophthalmologist if you're not trained as one. You're obviously dealing with other things like, amblyopia and postoperative refractive care. So, you know, have that relationship before you start diving into pediatric retina surgery. And I think paramount to all of this is just having good communication with everyone involved, you know, the physicians who refer to you, your team, and I think very importantly, educating the parents and the families, right, so that they understand exactly what's happening with their child and take the time to do that. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, bottom line, it's all about the patient, right? And I think that for us, you know, we come out very well trained in general as adult retina specialists, but the pediatric sort of feel in the pediatric retina, it's a very different situation and you have different considerations.
So that ties into our last subject, which is your role in international ophthalmology and ROP and telemedicine. So one of the roles you have to do for telemedicine is one is education of local doctors, but right now, where are we in terms of telemedicine for ROP, and what do you see in the future in terms of advances to overcome the challenges we still face?
Yeah, so, you know, you're hitting on something I care about deeply, right? So the international world and how we technology to actually improve access. So in terms of telemedicine, I think that we're at a point right now where it can be utilized. I think that we know that it works for identified disease. I think that there are a lot of systems all around the world, you know, India, New Zealand, the U.S., you know, and, you know, other programs that we're trying to get started in, like, for example, in Nepal, where they are going to be using telemedicine methods, you know, to improve access to care for these children. So we know that it's good at detecting disease. We know that it's good in terms of improving access to care. And a lot of these countries are well-equipped in terms of broadband internet to accommodate it, right? So it's really just going to get better and better, right? So I think that as the camera systems improve, that's going to be very beneficial for all of us who, you know, who want to do this. And I think that what's interesting right now, you know, where are we going? You know, where we're going really is image analysis, right? So using computer-based image analysis to potentially help us identify disease even better than human, maybe, right? But as, you know, it's synergistic with the human diagnosis as well. But if you can get a computer to potentially make a diagnosis for you, you know, you may be able to actually, again, improve more access to care in general. So that is the future, really. And I think that we're going to be seeing more and more of this, you know, as developing countries, you know, then start to see, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, start to see ROP, right, and emerging epidemics there.
Right. And I think what you've talked about and what you've done, and I know it's near and dear to your heart, I think it's just very impressive in terms of what we're able to do and what we're going to be able to do, some of the imaging technology you've talked about is fantastic. And I mean, what do you think in terms of the global burden of, you know, ROP? Do you think this is something that's underreported because of access?
I think to a certain extent, you know, I think that, you know, it's, you know, right now we are seeing a third epidemic. And I think that, for those of us who, you know, who deal with it, we're seeing it everywhere, right? And I think that you're going to start to see, reports in sub-Saharan Africa of ROP. And, you know, we have, friends in Nigeria who are starting to see it more and more often. You know, so it's becoming a reality. Mm-hmm. To answer your question directly, it's hard to say, you know, is it underreported or not? You know, for, you know, it's kind of like we're used to seeing what, you know, what we look for, right? And, you know, from my perspective, you know, we're seeing it a lot. You know, from a numbers perspective, you know, is it as, you know, we're seeing as many ROP children as, you know, bad diabetics in the world? You know, probably not, right? It's a different order of magnitude. But when you look at the lifetime burden of a blind child, right, and how it affects an economy, how it affects families, you know, these children otherwise are surviving, right? But they're going blind because of this condition.
How about the role of being a mentor? I mean, to seeing your mentees or proteges go out and join the field, or even the current people who are under you, whether they're residents, fellows, or medical students, how does that impact your decision, to be in an academic career?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, looking back on, you know, our careers in general, you know, we can comment on all the people who, you know, give us advice and who mentor us, you know, who are more senior than us and who believe in us and support our careers. But I think that, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed, and I think that's really important in terms of our success in general as physicians, as academics, and, you know, in our projects, is the fact that we, you know, have this opportunity to be around really smart people, and oftentimes people who are smarter than us to a certain extent, and the people that we've mentored. You know, I've been very lucky to mentor, you know, a number of students and residents and fellows like, you know, Yoshi Yonokawa or Aaron Nagel or Samir Patel, and these people who've, you know, are going on and developing their careers, to, you know, basically also, progress and teach and share, you know, what, you know, their knowledge with others and take great care of patients. So I think, you know, mentoring is a two-way street, right? So, you know, we've been mentored by great people. And I think that we have this opportunity to mentor the next generation of physicians and academics and leaders. And, we learn from them as well. And, you know, I've, you know, to a certain extent, I've learned maybe as much from the people that, you know, have worked with us and have helped us get our, you know, our work done. And that's been incredibly rewarding for me, for sure.
Well, Dr. Chan, and thanks so much for being generous with your time talking about your life and your career. I know you said you're not prominent, but I think of you as prominent. So I think to a lot of us, you're kind of a role model and a mentor. And I'm happy that you were able to share a lot of this with our listeners. And we look forward to these advances as we go future and hearing more about the telemedicine and your work. So I really appreciate you coming on the program and sharing your insights. You know, final word, you know, you recently transitioned academic careers. You're at Cornell, as you mentioned, and now you're in Chicago. I think as a fellow, a lot of times you think that your first job is going to be your last job, and people have a lot of pressure on that first job. And obviously it's important to go to a good situation when you start, but it's, you know, I think what I've learned talking to people is whether you're in academics or private practice, things are fluid and things can change. So, any comment you want to make on just transitioning mid-career as an academic and, kind of the challenges and the reasons why that might happen?
Yeah. You know, I think it's a good, it's good to think about, you know, your job in terms of, you know, when you take a job, you don't want to take it thinking that this is, you know, a temporary job. You know, and by no means did I think that, you know, my job when I joined Cornell was going to be, you know, a temporary job. I felt that that was where I wanted to work. You know, I loved the people, you know, I loved my job. And, you know, I wanted to be there, right? I wasn't looking at it as sort of this, some sort of transition point. You know, but life changes, right? So for me, you know, I think that, you know, my career evolved, right, into something. my personal life evolved. You know, I think a big part of my move really was just, you know, I got married, right? And I got 2 years ago, and I got, you know, very lucky in that sense. You know, I spent about 10 years at Cornell. And what's interesting is, you know, people ask, well, when did you start thinking about whether or not you were going to leave? And, you know, it wasn't that I was actively looking for a job, but I, you know, I did entertain, other positions, right? So, you know, I first, you know, looked at a job when someone asked me to look, at, you know, a position with you, right? With you guys down at Bascom Palmer. And it sort of opens your eyes and you look at different perspectives. But really for me, what it came down to was I was going through a life transition in my personal life, right? So I was getting married and we had to make a choice, right? So I looked at a job in Boston with where she was, you know, at Mass Sinai, and looked at a job at Penn, you know. So we looked around, and I think what it came down to was really where were we both going to be happy and do professionally well and also do well personally, right? So I think an important aspect of just career is to never forget about the personal choices you make in your life. Mm-hmm. And also, it's not, you know, life in general and jobs in general, it's not just about money, right? It's about all these other things that you love doing professionally, right? So for me, it was the global health work, and, you know, coming to UIC opened a lot of doors to me in that sense. It was about, you know, helping, you know, being in the service that with people that I really enjoyed being with and that I respected in the community. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily about, was there anything wrong with my old job? It was more about what other opportunities are presented to you, where you could grow, right? But the bottom line is transitioning is hard.
Right.
And, it's really hard, you know, and you're starting new and, you know, in academics, you know, and again, you know, we talk about academics, but academics is sort of a state of mind, but, you know, in a full-time university practice, you know, you're leaving a city. You're not necessarily bringing a practice with you and you have to start fresh and you worry about, you know, will I get busy enough clinically? Will I have enough to do academically? Will the people in the new department, will that be, you know, a good relationship and will it be, you know, a family type atmosphere that I was used to? And you don't know these things, right? And, you know, will you be respected in the community? And, you know, it's been 2 years now and, you know, I would say, you know, moving, to a new city, starting a new practice, living together as a newly married couple, you know, those are all really hard transitions, but they're fun. And, you know, at this point now I could say that we're happy. Everything worked out. And, you know, I'm in a place where I really like the people. I feel like, you know, things are growing and, you know, we're doing good things, you know, so, and of course, you know, we're happily married. We're having a child.
Congratulations.
Great. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there's transitioning is hard. And I think it's always good to think about transitions, not when you're unhappy, right? But when things are going well.
Those are great words of advice. Well, Dr. Chan, I really appreciate you sharing about your work and your life with us. And hopefully I'll see you soon, maybe next week at Retina Society, and if not, at Academy for sure.
That's perfect. Thanks for talking, Jay. It's been fun.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thanks.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 68 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both the things we can do better and things we are already doing well. Keep sending us episode ideas. They'll help us deliver content relevant and useful to you, the listener. Many thanks to Dr. R.V. Paul Chan for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai and Mike Benincasa for the great production and editing. Finally, thank you, the listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.